You are listening to The Gaggle. This is The Gaggle for Tuesday, April 26, 2016. The guest is Nick Merrill, traveling press secretary for Secretary Clinton. This is The Gaggle.
This week we have on Nick Merrill. Nick Merrill is traveling press secretary for Secretary Hillary Clinton. Nick, it is a pleasure to have you on.
Oh, thank you, David. Good to be here.
Thank you. Nick and I have actually known each other for some time, and Nick has been hard to get to because Nick has been traveling around the country these past for about a year now, I think. Nick, where have you been in the past few months?
Well, let's see. That would take us back to March. February, I guess. So after New Hampshire, we went to Nevada, and then spent some time in Florida, Colorado, Ohio, Illinois, Missouri, Massachusetts, North Carolina, and most recently, I'm sure I'm leaving some out, most recently, we were in New York for a few weeks, which was nice because I got to go home. Most nights, which is a rarity. And then the last few days and through Tuesday, we'll be in Pennsylvania, Connecticut, Maryland, Delaware, and Rhode Island.
And how much of that time when you're in other states do you get to fly back to New York and go home? Or do you spend most of the time staying in hotels when you're in all those different states?
It depends where we are. If we're out in Iowa or when we were spending time there, when we're out in the West Coast, you know, we'll spend a few nights out. But we try to only be on the road for 3 or 4 days at a time and then come home. And, you know, these states that are closer by, it's usually just easier for everybody to come home at night. So it's nice when we're campaigning in neighboring states.
Now, do you typically travel with the press when you're driving around, or do you travel with the secretary, or is it both?
Well, it's sort of evolving. The way it works is we have a plane, and then the press were for the first 10 months of the campaign or so traveling on their own, sort of planes, trains, and automobiles, getting themselves places. And now they have their own charter. So sometimes I'll fly on the charter plane with them, and sometimes I'll fly with the secretary. And, you know, if they're with us on the ground, I'll spend a couple of legs on the bus with them. But I think we all agree we see plenty of each other regardless. So,
got it. And so what is a typical day of Nick Merrill like? What time do you generally wake up? I mean, is there such a thing as a typical day?
There's some pattern to it. Today was a little atypical. We were up a little earlier than usual. We're up at 5. We were taping a town hall with Good Morning America at live in the 8 o'clock hour. So everybody was up early. We did a briefing call about 6, and then I went down to the studio about 7. But on most days, I try to get up an hour or two before we leave, read the briefing book, read the clips. And then I would say we start campaigning usually about 9:30, 10 every day, and ends about 9:10 at night.
So, what is the difference between you as a spokesperson and another spokesperson, like the national spokesperson? You do the traveling, and the other person stays in one place.
Yeah, it depends, and it varies campaign by campaign. But the way we do it on our campaign is there is a national press secretary who sort of is back in Brooklyn and in the headquarters, running the things out of the mothership. We have a deputy spokesperson, and then we have a communications director who plays many roles, but one of them is that sometimes she travels on the road. And in terms of sort of who deals with who, you know, we have a traveling press corps that's comprised of about 10, 15 people, depending on the day, what we're doing, what, you know, what's coming up. And I sort of talk to them primarily, you know, both on and off the record, just kind of keeping each other informed on what the secretary's doing, if she's rolling out a policy, you know, try to give them a window into our thinking. And then back at headquarters, you know, they're sort of working on the bigger picture, laying out, you know, what our message is going to be for the next day, or if we have a policy rollout, coordinating that. That's sort of how we divvy it up. But, you know, it's a campaign, so it's you can pretend there's order to it, but there's ultimately not. We just sort of take incoming as it comes.
What is the process in getting a narrative that you want told? How do you work with a reporter? Does it work? Does it take several months? Does it take several days? Does it happen in an afternoon? How do you work with a reporter? What is that process like? And can you talk us a little bit through what it means to be on the record, off the record, on background? A little bit of the whole operation here.
Sure. Let me take that part first because it's easy. There are, you know, sort of three ways in which you talk to a reporter. One is on the record. You know, that just means you are talking to them in such a way that they can quote you directly, use your name, and, you know, attribute it to you. If you're talking to somebody on background, it's a method used for a variety of reasons. But it means that, you know, the reporter can attribute to sort of generally who you are, anything from as specific as a campaign spokesperson to, you know, a Democrat. And that's used a fair amount. I think a lot of people would argue it's overused today. And then, of course, talking to somebody off the record means that, you know, it's not for attribution or even use in their story, but just sort of a way to give them some context and texture on. The media landscape is much more complex today than it was even 4 years ago, but certainly 8 years ago. You have Twitter, which is just, you know, sort of much more prolific. You have, you know, other forms of social media, and you have pressure on the part of journalists to be, you know, reporting in real time, you know, via those mediums. So what that sort of manifests itself into is, you know, there's a lot of reacting. Your opponent, either, you know, on the other side here in the Democratic Party or one of the Republican candidates says something, you know, that can kind of change your whole day. So what that means in terms of your affirmative message is, you know, you have to sort of have components that all fit together, which I don't think that's a new concept. You know, you spend a week talking about education, you spend a week talking about gun control, which is something we are actually doing this week. But it requires a lot of repetition, and it requires, you know, I think there's something that works to Secretary Clinton's advantage, is it requires you laying out, you know, fairly detailed policy proposals, which you can, you know, lay out for one reporter or several reporters, depending on the issue, and then sort of point people to that as a sort of precursor to, you know, then the candidate, the most powerful tool, going out there and articulating your views event to event. Now that, you know, that sort of how pertains to us. You know, it, interestingly, on the other side in the Democratic primary, you have a Bernie Sanders who has a stump speech, and he mostly sticks to that stump speech, and has been doing that for the last, 10 months since he got into the race. So I guess my point is that it's a difficult thing to do, but what it also means is you can, you know, you can reach a lot of different audiences. You can sort of have, you know, more than one thing going on if you want to sort of get to various constituency groups. You know, finding a thread to sort of weave it all together, I think, is important. Otherwise, it gets lost in the noise.
Do you think that you are calmer now than you were 8 years ago? Do you think you need to be calm in your field?
Calmer? Are you suggesting I wasn't calm when we first met?
No, I'm not saying that from a personal perspective. I'm saying, do you think that in order to be successful, you can't react to everything in order to get crazed?
You know, I think that is important in the evolution of anybody in politics, whether it's the candidate or the staffer. It's probably true in life as well, not to get too deep about it. But, you know, one of the great things about working for Hillary Clinton is she has put up with a lot of noise for a lot of years. So she has thick skin and she keeps her eye on the important things and on the big picture. And, you know, it doesn't mean we don't deal with some of the annoying stuff or the problematic stuff as it comes in, but you gotta let it roll off your back, because as you're sort of alluding to, you know, things fizzle out, both good and bad, pretty quickly.
What is the best thing that you have seen behind closed doors with her? Is it that her personality is a certain way, or is it that something that maybe hasn't been seen in the public? A story you can share?
Yeah, I get this question a lot, and there's sort of this expectation that she is very different behind closed doors, that she, you know, has this much more animated side to her that, you know, sort of endears people to her. And there's some truth to that, but it's not quite true. I think, you know, she talks about this more and more, particularly recently, but, she is, as she will tell you, not a natural politician. And I think, you know, that's one of a couple things that people need to understand in trying to understand her. She did not intend to run for office. I say that with complete confidence that it is true. She was sort of, you know, her husband, of course, always wanted to run for office, and, you know, would have told you that probably 40 years ago. But that was not her plan. She wanted to be a lawyer. She wanted to be an advocate. She wanted to work on public policy and focus on helping families and children from, you know, sectors that were, you know, maybe even in government, but certainly not, you know, being an elected official. And then she ran for the Senate, and, you know, we'll tell you that she is not necessarily a natural at this. So I think what that ultimately means is there is, you know, there is a filter. A lot of what you do with your day is by definition manufactured. You know, if you're having a conversation with a group of young people, you're not actually just having a conversation with a group of young people like we did this morning. You know, we were on Good Morning America, and you are ultimately under lights and cameras and millions of people are watching. And I think what that means is through that filter, people often come off as maybe, you know, not as dynamic, or I think this is a particular problem, you know, with respect to sort of gender stereotypes. Is, you know, people do not know what to expect in a female candidate, so they don't really know what basis they're judging things on. And I think that, you know, when you put all that together, there you get this idea that, you know, she's sort of a little colder, and, you know, or not human, or whatever the accusations are. And you know, it's funny because I spend an enormous amount of time with this person, and I find her to be incredibly warm, incredibly caring. She's focused, but that's a good thing. I mean, you wouldn't want, you know, sort of an unfocused candidate for president that isn't always thinking about, you know, what they can be doing better, what they can be doing differently, and what the ultimate goal is. So, you know, I think for all those reasons, people expect her to be different in private. And the truth is, you know, she is much the same. It just conveys differently when it's not through a TV camera or not in front of, you know, the sort of lights and people. And but she's warm, and she's funny, and she takes an interest in what's going on in the lives of the people around her.
you know, it's it makes doing the job fun.
Before you were on the campaign, you were at the State Department, and you traveled to many, many countries. Can you describe a little bit what you did at the State Department, and also an estimate, or do you have an actual number of how many countries you traveled to?
Sure. So I went to the State Department about 6 months after she got there, as you well know, as you were also there at the time. And she, you know, she was a very, as you also well know, different kind of Secretary of State. She, particularly as compared to her predecessor, and that's not a dig on her predecessor, but Secretary Rice was, had, you know, a very regimented schedule in which she would travel. She would do what's called a bilateral meeting with, you know, either the foreign minister of a country or the president or prime minister. She would do maybe a press availability, some closed door meetings, and she would come home. And it was, you know, it was pretty formulaic and pretty traditional. I think because of who Hillary Clinton is and the time that she came into office, she wanted to do it a little differently. You know, our standing in the eyes of people around the world was at best uncertain, and at worst just downright lousy. You know, I remember looking when we came in at somebody had done polling of, you know, how foreign countries perceived America, and after, you know, 8 years of the Bush administration, where there was this sort of lack of community and, you know, paying attention to our alliances and, you know, doing things with coalitions, that I think people were sort of disenchanted with the way American power was handling itself. And, you know, it wasn't what career diplomats, both within the department and around the world, wanted. So what her focus was to go around and do the bilateral meetings, meet with the foreign ministers and the presidents and the prime ministers, but use this sort of, you know, international image that she had, you know, already, the presidential candidate, foreign first lady, to do town halls with young people around the world, to partner with media outlets and use that as a way to both talk to people but have them produce a show that we could air nationwide. So what I was brought in to do originally was to kind of go. And I'd worked on a campaign, I'd set up events on a campaign, so to go set those things up, which was, you know, it's really exciting. I went to all these places I'd never been to before. You know, I think my first month I was in, you know, Afghanistan and Pakistan and Russia and Singapore, Western Europe. And what that sort of morphed into was I ended up being one of a few people that would travel on the plane with her and take care of the press corps that we traveled with at all times, which is usually about 15 diplomatic correspondents that would be with us, and take care of their logistics and, you know, make sure they knew where they were going, and just sort of be there, you know, like professional camp counselor / cruise director when we were on these trips. I don't know exactly how many countries I went to, but I should count, but it was, you know, something like, she went to 112, I probably went to 75 or 80 of them with her,
wow,
which is pretty amazing in retrospect.
Pretty amazing, yeah, incredibly amazing. So my final question is, you seem to do what you love. I want to ask you, if you were to give advice to someone else to tell them how to do what they love, what advice would you give?
You know, I get asked that a lot. As you know, you know, we're both similar ages, and you get to a point where you start routinely talking to a lot more young people who ask you that question, you know, as you get into your late 20s, early 30s, and, you know, people want advice. I didn't set out to do anything in particular. I was abroad working for an NGO after college. I came back. The presidential race was starting. I didn't particularly have a career path in mind, but I thought it would be really fun and good experience to work on the presidential race. So I did that in 2007. And, you know, sort of ended up where I am. And I love my job mostly because I love, you know, the people I work with, and, you know, just particularly this you know, incredible person that I work for. But my advice to people is, particularly in this day and age, is, you know, when you finish college, if you're not sure what you want to do, you know, it's one thing you want to be a cardiologist. There's a very set of things that you need to do that, or, you know, an attorney, or you know, any trade. But the most important thing is to find people that are smart and multifaceted in their intelligence. You know, they're good with people. They understand, you know, the issue area, whatever space you're talking about, and you know, are willing to mentor. And it to be perfectly honest, I firmly believe this, it does not matter what you do as long as you can find something that fits that criteria. So, you know, that's what happened with me. I was working on a campaign. I liked the experience, but I knew I didn't want to be a career campaigner. But I had people around me that were very supportive. And, you know, ultimately took me with them to the State Department, which is actually what, you know, sort of one of the things I thought I might ultimately want to do, but still wasn't sure. And it just sort of evolved. And I think that, you know, one of the luxuries that we have now that, you know, our parents' generation didn't necessarily have, or didn't necessarily were exposed to, is that, you know, you don't have to pick a career path when you're 23. And, it, you know, you can try different things and figure out what you like and you don't like. And, you know, ultimately, as long as you can find smart people to be around who are going to, you know, help take care of you and help teach you, then you will end up where you want to be.
Nick Merrill, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, David. It's good having, it's good being here, and good luck with the podcast.
I appreciate it.